KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The tariff war is on pause for 90 days for most countries. President Trump reversed course after days of global chaos. We hear how U.S. companies are dealing with the remaining tariffs on Morning Edition from NPR News. Markets in Asia rose today after Trump paused most tariffs. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A former diplomat from Singapore talks of the pros of open markets and what a shift in U.S. trade policy signifies. Netflix's sci-fi series Black Mirror is back with a new season. We delve into the show's tech-focused storylines, including adapting to an AI-led world. It is Thursday, April 10th. Happy birthday to Q-Tip. The rapper-producer with A Tribe Called Quest is 55 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House is now voting on a budget blueprint for the federal government. House Speaker Mike Johnson has been working to win support from fiscal conservatives. They've said they're worried the measure doesn't do enough to cut the deficit. Johnson says the GOP will identify $1.5 trillion in savings. He says it will protect essential programs such as Medicaid. Democrats say that's not possible under the GOP plan. They say Americans who need these benefits could lose them. Markets continue to fall on Wall Street a day after President Trump paused some of his tariffs on dozens of nations. In reaction, the European Union says it will pause some of its tariffs for the same amount of time. But Trump increased tariffs on China to at least 125%. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro continues to insist tariffs are key to American prosperity.
We're in a beautiful position for the next 90 days. We've got over 75 countries that are going to come in and negotiate with us. And what they're going to have to do without fail is they're going to have to lower their non-tariff barriers, because those are the bigger ones than the tariff barriers. And we're going to get a great deal for America and a great deal for the world.
Meanwhile, economists say the escalating trade war between the U.S. and China is likely to keep prices higher. NPR Scott Newman reports consumers are likely to see some of those prices stay higher for good.
Something known as price stickiness is an economic concept describing how prices that go up quickly come down slowly or not at all. Kenneth Louie is director of the Economic Research Institute of Erie at Penn State University.
When we have policies like tariffs, that's going to lead to an upward ratcheting of prices if we look at the historical evidence.
One factor could be manufacturers eventually shifting their supply chains away from the U.S., at a cost they would likely pass on to consumers. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has halted work on the National Climate Assessment. As NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports, it's the most comprehensive source of information on how climate change affects the U.S.
The National Climate Assessment is required by Congress, and the next one was expected in 2027. The report includes the latest information about sea level rise, changing weather patterns, and other climate change effects. It's written in plain language, so everyone from farmers and fishermen to teachers and judges can use it. A small staff of about 25 people helps coordinate the hundreds of scientists who write the report. Now the federal government has canceled the contract that paid for those staff, according to two government officials with direct knowledge of the cuts. They agreed to speak to NPR on the condition of anonymity because they fear professional retaliation. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down more than 1,000 points. The Nasdaq is down more than 600. This is NPR. The United States and Russia have exchanged prisoners. Russia has released Ksenia Karolina. She was jailed in Russia after giving less than $100 to a charity that sent relief aid to Ukraine. Russia says the U.S. has released Russian-German citizen Arthur Petrov. He was accused in the U.S. of illegally exporting military-grade electronics. Scientists have replicated a pathway that senses pain using human nerve cells grown in a dish. NPR's John Hamilton reports on a study in the journal Nature.
Pain signals start at a nerve ending, then travel to the spinal cord, to an area deep in the brain, and finally to the brain's outer layer, the cortex. A team at Stanford recreated this pathway using clusters of human neurons designed to mimic each stop along the way. Dr. Sergio Pashka says then they exposed the nerve endings on one cluster to a chemical found in chili peppers.
The neurons that sense the signals get activated, and they transmit that information to the next station and the next station all the way to the cortex.
Pashka says this sensory pathway in a dish could be used to test drugs meant to block pain. John Hamilton, NPR News.
There are flood warnings up in several states this morning, from Ohio to the Gulf Coast. This follows several days of storms that started a week ago. The exceptionally heavy rain from the storm has surged into rivers, pushing them to major flood stage. Officials in Cincinnati say the Ohio River crested there yesterday at levels not seen in decades. Parts of downtown Cincinnati are flooded. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Coming up, the Trump administration's back and forth on tariffs has roiled markets, and customers are paying the price. In a few minutes, we'll speak with the CEO of a major grocery chain about how he's responding.
But first, the European Union is pausing its retaliatory tariffs on the U.S. after some dramatic turns in President Trump's trade policy on Wednesday.
Early in the morning, his steep new tariffs went into effect. Then he told Americans to, quote, be cool as markets plunged. But by afternoon, he backed off and put a 90-day pause on most of the tariffs. Markets soared.
Everybody wants to make a deal, actually. And, you know, we want to do what's right for our country. We also want to do what's right for the world.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez was there. He joins us now. Good morning, Franco.
Good morning, Leila.
So you were at the White House yesterday in the Oval Office. Tell us about this really big day.
Yeah, it was a really big day. I mean, for weeks, his team had insisted that Trump was going to hold the line. And just days ago, Trump even wrote on social media in all capital letters, my policies will never change. And then they did in another social media post. And this is how Trump explained it at the White House.
Well, I thought that people were jumping a little bit out of line. They were getting yippy, you know, they were getting a little bit yippy, a little bit afraid.
You know, he also talked about concerns in the bond market, and then he downplayed all those concerns. And Trump and his aides began painting this as being part of their strategy all along.
So how much of this had to do with the markets? Is this an about face?
You know, there's no mistaking the turmoil that the markets were under, and it was getting worse and worse. Top investors were pleading with Trump. Some were almost begging him to do this very thing. Issue a 90-day pause. Now, Trump did say you have to be flexible in your policies, but he insisted this was the right thing to do.
Okay, so what happens now? There's a 90-day pause, and then what?
Yeah, I mean, we should be clear that the administration is keeping a baseline 10% tariff on imports,
okay,
which is a big deal. But it is nothing, nothing like what he was threatening, such as a 46% tariff against Vietnam. Well, so now they've begun these discussions with these countries on what they've described as tailor-made negotiations for each, though we don't really know what that involves. But, you know, his goals on this have always been kind of unclear. They've talked about the tariffs being about reducing the trade deficit. They've talked about the tariffs being about bringing back manufacturing. They've talked about the tariffs being about boosting government revenue. So it's always kind of been this mixed bag.
Right. And then to be clear, the president has spent a lot of time talking about China's trade practices. And again, those tariffs are still there on China. So how does this shift affect the country?
Yeah, another really big deal. I mean, while he paused the tariffs on most everyone else, he doubled down on China, raising the tariffs to 125%. He said it was punishment when China announced their own retaliatory tariffs. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said China made a mistake and was basically being isolated as a result.
You might even say that he goaded China into a bad position. They responded, they have shown themselves to the world to be the bad actors.
Now, Trump said he did not think he would need to raise the China tariffs any further. And even though he had some very harsh words about China's trade abuses, he actually called Xi Jinping a friend and said he expects Xi to eventually call. And then he says they'll work out a deal. So all of that is something we'll be watching for.
That's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you, Leila.
Now let's turn to the impact of tariffs on your food bill. And for that, we're going to head to Stu Leonard's. If you buy groceries in New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut, you probably know the chain. It's still family-owned, and it shows. There are costumed characters in the aisles, a few petting zoos, and even dancing vegetables.
We're avocados, we're avocados. We have a song to sing for you.
Okay, so those aren't really vegetables. They're animatronics. But anyway, like every other grocery store in the U.S., Stu Leonard's is trying to figure out how to manage these huge shifts. So we've called CEO Stu Leonard Jr. to ask how he's dealing with these ups and downs. And he's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you today?
Better now that I'm talking to you.
Okay. Good,
so there are thousands of items in any grocery store, but can you give us a sense of what percentage of what's on the shelves is subject to tariffs?
Well, right now, what we're mainly focused on actually is all of the wine and the spirits. And a lot of those importers that bring these products in are small businesses. So the food part of it, we get 1 million pounds of salmon from Canada every year. But that's, since it's a fresh product, is not tariffed right now. And then Mexico, the big item I worry about down there are basically avocados and tequila, because you can't buy them anywhere else in the world. California does some avocados too, but not enough to supply the needs that you have. So mainly the products that are keeping me awake at night are you know, the tequila, the avocados. We get our New Zealand lamb, we got Easter, and these are small farmers that we deal with, you know?
Yeah, so what are those conversations like? Have you had to raise prices? Have they raised prices? What's going on there?
I'm on the phone sometimes twice a day with a lot of our farmers and ranchers. You know, basically, they're feeling just overall financial pressure at their farms right now. But, you know, if they get hit with a 10 or 20% tariff, you know, these are families. They don't run these big companies. So usually what we do, and we did it during COVID, was when we needed product and they told us that the prices had gone up, we usually worked it out where we split it with them.
You split it. Okay.
So Stu Leonard's eats half of it and they eat half of it. And most of them are happy with that.
Have these tariffs caused you to feel you had to raise prices on anything in particular so far?
Well, the good news is just about all our suppliers are doing a wait and see right now. In the food business, I know we're like a bullseye right now, the food industry, as far as inflation and so forth. But you know what? Right now, you need volume in the food business. We don't want to see sales go down. If we raise prices, sales go down unless you're Gucci or Prada or something. I don't know what'll happen by dinner time today. But you know, that's important to us right now.
So what, go back to what's keeping you up at night, right? You said it's the avocados, it's the tequila, it's the sort of the lamb. I think some people might say, okay, you know, tequila's not an essential. Avocados, kind of, maybe. Well, so if people don't buy it, then is that really a big deal? If there's achieved some long-term goal of kind of reorienting the economy toward, say, something advantaging American businesses, American vendors more so?
Well, I would say just about every product you can buy from Europe, and we don't buy much from China, and this is only affecting less than 5% of our business right now. So we're mainly fresh and perishable. But you can buy a lot of these products in the U.S., Brie cheese, for instance, a beautiful 70% or a full cream you get from France. The same family has moved over to Wisconsin and is producing Brie. And it's $2 a pound less. So, okay, there's great European wine, chateaus and all that stuff. But California, is amazing. Washington State, I think people are going to start buying more U.S. wines.
All right. We have to leave it there for now, Mr. Leonard. That's Stu Leonard Jr. He's the CEO of the supermarket chain, Stu Leonard's. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Michelle, it was a pleasure. Have a nice day.
In a win for the White House, a federal appeals court has paved the way for the administration to once again fire probationary federal workers who had just been reinstated. It's the latest jolt for employees at scores of different federal agencies. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Tens of thousands of federal workers were suddenly fired right after President Trump took office. They had what's called probationary status because they were hired recently or they just got promoted. Two different lawsuits alleged, though, that the firings were illegal, and two federal judges both ordered that the workers be rehired as the cases move forward. The government did hire back thousands of workers, but this week, those judges' orders were both paused, one by the Supreme Court, the other by an appeals court in Maryland, apparently clearing the way for the administration to fire the workers all over again if it chooses to.
This is pandemonium, and it's obviously causing a lot of confusion.
Michelle Berkovich is an employment attorney who's been working on other legal efforts to help probationary workers. She says she's been hearing from some of them over the past couple of days.
Folks are just at a loss. This is unfortunately not going to be the quick solution that we were hoping to see.
The Trump administration has framed the mass firings of federal workers as part of an effort to target inefficiency, waste, fraud, and abuse. The president last month, after a cabinet meeting, spoke about his administration's efforts, as he put it, cutting a lot of people.
Many didn't come to work. Many had no intention of coming to work. Many were paid and working someplace else. There were lots of bad scenarios, but they're being weeded out.
Berkovich says for probationary workers, that is just not true.
That is absolutely not true. I can say I've looked at a database of about 10,000 employees, probationary employees terminated. Most of them had glowing reviews whose supervisors are profusely apologizing for being forced to fire them despite their great work.
One of the lawsuits was filed in California. It alleges, among other things, that the government lied to thousands of workers about why they were being fired. The judge at a hearing at one point said, quote, "It is a sad day when our government would fire some good employee and say it was based on performance when they know good and well that that is a lie." The government maintains that the firings were proper. Berkovich notes that despite this setback for workers, both of these lawsuits will keep moving ahead.
The two cases are ongoing. They are not dead in the water by any means.
Still, she's telling workers if they find another good job, they should probably take it. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. of the next fresh air. Journalist Gardner Harris talks about his book investigating Johnson & Johnson. Last month, the company lost a bid to settle lawsuits that claimed its talc powder products, including baby powder, caused cancer. Johnson & Johnson faces tens of thousands of claims. Harris's book is called No More Tears. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Total Wine & More for discovering something new, like a Cabernet or single barrel bourbon. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldad.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. In a world where we become more and more reliant on technology, Black Mirror shows us just how vulnerable we might be. Black Mirror is a hit sci-fi series on Netflix of short stories exploring our relationship with tech and what could happen if things go off the rails. I spoke with Charlie Brooker, the show's creator, about the latest season out today. It kicks off with an episode about the degradation of tech services over time.
Rashida Jones plays a regular woman who, there's a medical emergency and her husband signs her up to a service that cloud stream part of her brain. But the problem is it comes with a subscription tier and she starts spouting adverts.
Families that stay together bask in the glow of Christ's heart. For more information on faith-based family counseling, visit christsheart.com.
Okay.
There's another episode about the gaslighting of a rival at work.
But coming at it from a slightly sort of tech perspective.
What I don't understand is how she changed the email. Like, how?
No, but she didn't.
Kay, I know what I wrote.
And I think we're sort of living in a time when we're all sort of being a bit gaslit.
In another episode, actor Paul Giamatti investigates what went wrong with an old romance. He uses technology that allows him to actually enter old photographs.
That's the day I met Carol. This would have been in Brooklyn.
We can enhance the moment by entering the image. Shall we go in?
What do you mean, go in?
It's easiest to just show you.
I mean, is that something that you've heard is a few years away, 10 years away, or 20 years away? Is that something you've heard about?
I would imagine that's probably 5 minutes away in some form. I mean, maybe not to the degree of sophistication that we show it unfolding in the actual episode itself, but certainly I think the speed with which these things evolve. I think we've all seen videos where somebody, you know, feeds a Van Gogh self-portrait to an AI and presses a button and then you've got a sort of animated video of him rapping or whatever. So the notion that you could sort of walk inside some kind of VR recreation of an old photograph, I suspect is really very much not far away.
Yeah. And that episode that you mentioned with Rashida Jones, where she is basically part of this tiered system of operating, right? In some, it's like, I think we all live in tiers, right? In every single thing that we subscribe to, there's always something better or something worse. You either have an ad-free experience or you don't. And that ad-free experience is supposed to be better than the one that has the ads.
Yes, but it's weird. You're right. The tier system, I mean, especially being British, you can't help being British growing up, you're acutely aware of the class system. And it's just, we've sort of got this new version of it constantly, where everything, there's a sort of the premium version, the standard version, and the kind of rubbish version of everything.
Right, because I think the feeling is that if you're in the lower tier, you're not having as good of an experience. But then all of a sudden, how high do the tiers go? I mean, it's infinite, right? The sky is infinite.
I was flown to the USA, and as I got on the plane, I got randomly upgraded. Like, I'd never been in business class before, and I was marveling at, like, oh my God, I've got a big screen here, and I've got proper cutlery, and wow, they've brought out a tablecloth. On the flight back, I was in economy, I was in coach on the flight back, and I was instantly angry. was no longer sort of, I felt instantly like, how dare they do this to me? It's terrifying how quickly that seizes you.
Is technology screwing up with our brains? Like, if you got a phone, all of a sudden there's an upgrade. You need that upgrade because you don't want to go back to life the way it was with the old phone.
Yeah. So the slight problem is that, like, what phones have done is they've made... I can't work out, was reality always boring and we were just waiting for phones to come along and distract us? Is that what's happened? Or have the phones kind of, you know, mesmerized us and rewired our brains? You drop into a soothing mini coma every time you're fiddling with a phone, basically. It feels like you're doing something and you're not really. I mean, I call it soothing. Often these days you're sort of doom scrolling, which is the opposite of soothing, but then you're locked into that, right? Because you're constantly doing it, hoping for some kind of reassurance, like a frightened animal. Doing Black Mirror, I think often people assume it's sort of written by the Unabomber, that I'm sort of like some anti-tech, do you know what I mean? Like sitting in a log cabin and, like, you know, scowling at... But no, I used to be a video games journalist. I love sort of... Yeah. This would be a terrible job to do if you hated technology. And a lot of these things are miraculous, really miraculous inventions that we've created and incredibly powerful tools. It's just, you know, they come with unforeseen consequences and they're powerful tools.
Yeah. I never saw Black Mirror as you being anti-tech.
Oh, good.
I mean, I think what Black Mirror is to me is something that what might happen if maybe we allow it to dominate us.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I suppose really in almost all of our episodes, the problems come in when a human is misusing something or they're not thinking through the consequences of what they're doing, or they're driven by fear, or they're driven by jealousy or weakness. That's usually the problem, whereas the technology itself is a neutral tool. And also in the show, we have to show technology that you would want to use yourself.
Yeah.
That's sort of, for me, the measure of a really good Black Mirror episode is when you can absolutely, as a viewer, see the value of the tech we're showing you, and you'd sort of wish it existed, or you wish you could have it. I mean, you probably will in 10 months' time.
Yeah. One last thing, Charlie. What do you want to come out of Black Mirror? I mean, do you want Black Mirror to maybe change the way we use technology, the way governments regulate it, especially maybe with AI regulation? What would you like to come out if people have a lesson from Black Mirror?
You know, I'm not trying to sort of influence policy. I'm not trying to sort of... I slightly get confused sometimes when people describe the show as a warning about the potential uses of technology. It's more I'm worrying. It's more that it's me worrying in what I hope is an entertaining way. That said, often we're showing cautionary uses of technology, but hopefully there's some optimism also mixed into the casserole as well. Was that an answer, or did I dodge that question?
You did both, I think, Charlie, but that's good enough for me.
Oh, perfect.
Charlie Brooker is the writer and creator of the series Black Mirror. Season 7 is now streaming on Netflix. Charlie, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is NPR News.
The punk rock band Blink-182 was as popular as ever when they broke up.
It felt like my world had ended. It felt like I had gotten divorced, like someone had died. It felt like a huge sense of loss.
I'm Juana Summers. In his new book, lead singer Mark Hoppus tells the story of how one of the biggest bands in the world overcame all the small things on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. House Republicans have narrowly passed a key budget blueprint. The GOP now begins the process of drafting a multi-trillion-dollar bill to enact President Trump's domestic priorities, including tax cuts, defense spending, and immigration restrictions. The rate of inflation in the U.S. has cooled. Today, the Labor Department reported the consumer price increase from March 2024 to March of this year, 2.4%, was not as much as the 2.8% year-over-year rate posted in February. U.S. markets are back in sobering territory. A fierce sell-off resumed at the opening bell. Major indices are down 3% to more than 4% a day after a historic rally on President Trump's announcement of a 90-day tariff pause for most countries on his latest levies. Not for China, though. NPR's Scott Horsley is watching the fallout of the standoff between the planet's two biggest economies.
When it comes to China, the trade war is still very much in force, and that is a headache for people like Bonnie Ross. She imports clothing from China to sell at discount stores like Burlington and Dee's. Ross notes that over the last week, Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods have gone from 20% to 54% to 104% and now 125%.
NPR's Scott Horsley. At last check, we see the Dow is down more than 1,200 points or more than 3%. This is NPR. As Maryland resident Kilmar Abrego Garcia spends another day detained in El Salvador after he was mistakenly deported in February, his wife, Jennifer Vasquez Sura, is appealing to lawmakers to intervene. She was on Capitol Hill yesterday.
We're not going to give up hope to the Supreme Court justice, to the right thing. History will always remember you.
On Monday, Chief Justice John Roberts agreed to pause a lower court's midnight deadline for the administration to return Abrego Garcia as the case is litigated. British lawyers acting on behalf of Hamas are challenging the British government's designation of that group as a terrorist organization. It's believed to be the first such appeal of its kind. Here's NPR's Lauren Frayer.
In a video clip released by his law firm, London attorney Fahad Ansari says he's submitting a more than 100-page application to the UK Home Office, challenging a ban on Hamas in this country.
We have the application here, which contains very, very strong legal arguments grounded in national and international law.
Lawyers representing Hamas allege that the UK is breaching the rights of Hamas supporters by, quote, unlawfully restricting their freedom of speech and right to protest. British law says it's illegal to belong to Hamas or even to wear clothing that's seen to support it. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, London.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Asian markets rallied this morning, hours after Wall Street made an historic one-day recovery. The markets turned around dramatically yesterday after President Trump announced a 90-day pause in steep tariffs for countries other than China. President Trump says tariffs are meant to strengthen the U.S. economy long-term, but analysts around the world expressed fears that the volatility could tip the global economy into recession. Among those raising alarms is a former diplomat from Singapore. Our colleague A. Martinez spoke with the former permanent secretary of Singapore's Ministry of Foreign Foreign Affairs, and that conversation was just before President Trump's tariff reversal.
Slow global growth is not good for Singapore because international trade is 300 times the size of a gross domestic product.
And Bilahari Kausikan says he doesn't think it's good for the U.S. either.
I can't find a single economist, except perhaps those working in the second Trump administration, who thinks that tariffs will have a very positive effect on American growth in the long term. It will lead to inflation. It will lead to perhaps loss of confidence.
Do you understand why President Trump is taking this route? Is this something that, if you look at it somehow with a longer lens, that maybe there is some sense to this?
Well, if I take a very broad view, a long kind of view, right? Why was America very open and generous? I think the fundamental reason was because of the strategic imperatives of the Cold War. You open your markets generously as a strategic tool in the Cold War, in the existential struggle against the Soviet Union. Now, no Soviet Union, why should Americans continue to paraphrase John F. Kennedy, bear any burden, pay any price, fight any foe in order to uphold your vision of international order? I can't think of any.
Now, some analysts would argue that U.S. tariffs could push Southeast Asian countries to shift closer to China, both economically and politically. Do you think that's likely or even possible if these tariffs continue?
No, that's a very, very simplistic way of looking at it. It's condescending and insulting because it assumes that we are all so naive as not, or stupid as not to know our own national interests. And it's simplistic because, you know, China itself is going to be affected by these tariffs. Domestic demand in China is soft. It's not entirely clear that it can raise its domestic demand. It's been trying for more than a decade, don't forget, huh? And it's not had much success. So China is not going to be this great sponge that will absorb everything that we can't sell to America anymore.
Now, President Trump says these tariffs are about bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States. From your perspective, is that a strategy that could work in the long run?
You know, manufacturing left the United States for a whole variety of reasons, cheaper costs elsewhere only being one of them, right? And some manufacturing will certainly shift back to the United States. Many countries have announced quite substantive investments in the United States in the hope of getting relief from the tariffs. But, you know, it's not a question of shifting a plant of two. It's a question of shifting entire ecosystems that have grown up around particular sectors. So even if it's going to work, it's going to take a hell of a long time. And it may not work. It will work at best only partially. People who know the semiconductor industry much, 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 much better than I ever will tell me the U.S. is not ready. You don't have enough skilled semiconductor engineers or engineers of the right type. You don't have enough workers with the right skills. Now, in time, you will build that. You can build that, but that's not going to be done overnight.
Is it possible that if countries wind up getting into bilateral agreements with the United States on certain things, that we'll just have dozens and dozens of these all around the world for specific things and not have maybe a cohesive trade plan?
We haven't had a cohesive trade plan for a long time. The multilateral negotiations to liberalize world trade collapsed a long time ago. So you have got a whole mosaic of bilateral and plurilateral trade agreements among different groups of countries. Basically, the U.S. prefers to deal with countries bilaterally because that's where your leverage is. And Mr. Trump is an extreme example of that.
Bilahari Kausikan is the former permanent secretary of Singapore's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you for talking to me.
The Trump administration's shifting tariff policy has left consumers rattled and uncertain. But as NPR's Scott Newman reports, the price hikes caused by the trade war could linger even after it ends.
Whether or not we're aware of it, we're all a bit too familiar with a basic tenet of economics. Prices go up quickly, but come down slowly. or not at all.
If you look at the trends in prices over a long stretch of history, it's much more common for prices to rise.
That's Kenneth Louie, director of the Economic Research Institute of Erie at Penn State University.
When we have policies like tariffs, that's going to lead to an upward ratcheting of prices if we look at the historical evidence.
Carola Binder, an associate professor at the University of Texas School of Civic Leadership, says this is due in part to something economists call price stickiness. It can be caused by a number of factors, including shifting supply chains and even the cost of changing prices. An example of this, she says, is a restaurant owner printing a new menu to reflect a higher price of guacamole.
If they think that prices of avocados are going to continue rising, then they're going to set prices higher now. And that's because of that price stickiness, because they know that they're not going to just instantly print a new menu like every hour as input prices are changing.
How long the tariffs last is another variable. Philip Braun, a clinical professor of finance at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, says if they go on long enough, companies will be forced to shift supply chains away from the U.S., causing further disruptions in markets. He says some items, like fuel and other commodities, are less sticky than manufactured goods, but ultimately companies will set whatever price the market will bear. And that could be bad news for consumers. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. This is NPR News.
Many law firms and universities are making deals with President Trump. An expert on authoritarian regimes talks about what she's learned from Hungary. Next time, Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Barbie has a new friend and he can hoop. Mattel teamed up with LeBron James's Family Foundation to launch a new Ken doll. It's the first such doll modeled after a male professional athlete. It will be a full inch taller than standard Ken dolls and carry a King James-sized price tag, $75. It features some classic LeBron James touches, headphones, a varsity jacket, and his Family Foundation emblem. LeBron says it's about inspiring kids to dream big. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A strike by a mental health therapist at Kaiser Permanente in Los Angeles is dragging into its sixth month. This week, eight of them took it to a new level, a hunger strike. NPR's Katie Riddle visited them on the picket line.
One day longer.
One day stronger.
There are dozens of people chanting and protesting outside this Kaiser Permanente medical center on a busy strip of Sunset Boulevard. But a handful of striking workers are conserving their energy, sitting quietly under a tent instead. They're on a five-day hunger strike. Adriana Webb is talking to a nurse who's come by to check on them.
Like, I felt like I was getting a little bit of chills. And I, like, Googled it and said it could be because, like, I'm in ketosis from not eating.
So that it's a little early for that. Okay. But it could be your blood sugar is a little bit low.
Okay.
Nurse David Verdinier is from a different union, not on strike. He's volunteered to do some medical oversight for these strikers.
The bigger thing is that you feel fine today, but, you know, your body's going through withdrawals, right? You're used to eating three meals a day.
These workers have been asking for the same pay and benefits as their colleagues who work in other types of healthcare, as well as more time in between patients. Aida Valdivia is a licensed therapist.
Having to do the hunger strike was a more escalated effort on our part. To let them know that we are serious, especially if we are willing to sacrifice, right?
She says many workers on strike are already sacrificing, draining savings, going to food banks, borrowing money. This is a way of making their suffering more public.
You know, we've had to limit our food anyway, so basically you are kind of starving us, Kaiser.
One of the people out here is Sal Roselli. He's the former president of the National Union of Healthcare Workers. He reads from the sign he's holding.
Same company, same work. Why not same wages, pension, benefits?
Lack of mental health parity is a national issue. One recent report showed people seeking the care of a psychologist, for example, were 10 times more likely to go out of network and pay more. California has passed some parity laws and been celebrated as a leader on mental health. Roselli says it's time for the state's medical institutions to show their commitment to this cause.
This hunger strike demonstration of such absolute commitment to forcing Kaiser to change, it will eventually have a national effect in terms of achieving parity, and the year will come where the term mental health care doesn't exist. It's simply health care.
Kaiser Permanente management is taking notice. Patty Clausen is a vice president for its Southern California region.
Having our employees go on a hunger strike is very disturbing to us.
Clausen argues that Kaiser Permanente does pay their mental health care workers competitively, even if it's not the same wages as some of their colleagues. Clausen says they're eager to keep talking.
We are committed to finding the common ground for all of us.
Back outside the medical center, the strikers have a special guest. After all, this would not be LA without a celebrity appearance.
My name's Tom Morello, and I'm a union man.
And longtime member of the band Rage Against the Machine. He stopped by to cheer on these strikers with a quick concert.
When I say union, you say power, union,
power,
union.
Morello leaves them with this message.
So, it's my belief that the future of the working class in this country will not be decided by Congress. It will not be decided in the courts. It will be decided by the solidarity of people just like you on days just like this. So
protesting, he says, can work, but it does mean enduring some pain and discomfort, and in this case, hunger. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Wow.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The Trump administration has halted a program to upgrade affordable housing across the country. The renovations would have made older places more livable and energy efficient. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on what the freeze means for people in one small Virginia town.
Linda Morgan loves living at Trinity Woods, a subsidized place for seniors in Emporia, Virginia, near the North Carolina border. But about 3 years ago, the aging central air conditioning sputtered and died.
In the afternoons, it's terribly hot.
She's 67 and shows me how she stays cool during long summers.
This is my portable air that I'm going to hook up this weekend in that window. And this is what you call the swamp cooler that I just put water in.
One in the living room, the other in the bedroom, plus a fan in the kitchen and three more fans where needed. Morgan's a retired nurse and especially worries about the many people here with asthma or other breathing problems.
We've sacrificed so much in our lives already, and to think that we cannot live in a comfortable, safe environment as we're older is just devastating to me.
That's why she and others were thrilled a year ago when Trinity Woods was awarded a $5 million loan to help finance a new HVAC system and other renovations. It was part of a billion-dollar program passed by Congress in 2022. Hundreds of affordable complexes got funding. But now that's been terminated by the cost-cutting team of Elon Musk, according to an internal email seen by NPR. The Department of Housing and Urban Development says the program is ongoing and it's evaluating other options to help communities. It says the Biden administration's energy efficiency crusade does not fit the agency's mission. Either way, money is not flowing. That does not go over well with Trinity Woods residents Dina Moore, Sonia Urquhart, and Lynn Mason. We sit and talk in the community room, which is harder to cool and already feels stuffy and warm, even in spring.
Last year, it was god awful. We couldn't stay in here. And we had bingo on Tuesday and Friday nights. We couldn't even play bingo.
It changes your routine, what time you get up. You know, I'm going to lay down when it get cooler. It's just, it's horrible.
I was praying and hoping that everything was going to come along and get renewed. This is home. When I came here, I didn't have nowhere to go.
The head of maintenance, Lester Jenkins, takes me out a side door.
This chiller right there.
The chiller, a large rusty metal box, is the backbone of the building's central air. But a marker shows it was installed in 1993, which is why it now sits silent and still. I asked Jenkins, how many years should a chiller last?
About 20.
So you got good out of it.
You got good out of it, sure did.
I have been pleading for at least 3 years to do something about this air conditioning.
Reverend Richard Bridgeford heads Norfolk Urban Outreach Ministry, which worked with HUD to develop Trinity Woods. As with all affordable housing, he operates on a shoestring and can't just raise rents to cover a major renovation. Plus, this kind of subsidized housing has no equity, so cannot take on debt.
You can't get any funds, any money to fix anything.
HUD's now frozen program provided a way to get that money.
This is how government works at its best.
Julia Gordon was an assistant housing secretary at HUD under the Biden administration. She says if this program were not on hold, it would help more than 30,000 people across 42 states.
It uses government funds to help the parts of private industry that are trying to provide affordable housing in today's housing market. It helps them save so much more money.
Trinity Woods, for example, could save money by switching from expensive propane to cheaper solar panels and heat pumps. To get this upgrade money, properties also have to remain affordable for at least 20 more years. Linda Couch, with the senior services nonprofit Leading Age, says that's crucial with such a severe shortage of low-cost housing.
The first tenet of any housing advocate is to preserve what we have.
There are legal challenges over this funding freeze, and Trinity Woods is searching for other money, though there's a lot of competition and it likely would not be nearly as much. They hope to at least get enough to replace the AC and give the frustrated seniors here some relief. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Emporia, Virginia.
Since President Trump took leadership of the Kennedy Center earlier this year, many artists have been trying to figure out how to proceed. Some canceled performances. Some reached out to the Kennedy Center's interim president, Richard Grinnell. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has this report.
Guitarist Yasmin Williams has played at the Kennedy Center many times.
I didn't like how so many artists were canceling shows there because I just know so many people who work there and they need the income.
But she's also worried about rollbacks in DEI initiatives. So she emailed President Richard Grinnell asking how President Trump feels about performance cancellations and what changes are being made to hiring and booking practices.
His response to that was, "Let me ask you this question. Would you play for Republicans or would you boycott if Republicans came to your show?"
She and Grinnell continued to email back and forth, but she didn't feel like he answered her questions. He told her she shouldn't believe what's written in, quote, "newspapers who exist to hate Republicans." Musician Kathy Fink, who's been performing at the Kennedy Center since the 1980s, wrote Grinnell in March with similar concerns. She quoted a Washington Post article, and this is how Grinnell responded.
"Can you tell me why you believe the Wash Post? We didn't cancel a single show. You were flat wrong."
NPR reviewed the email threads, and they appear to be legitimate. The Kennedy Center did not respond to NPR's multiple requests for comment. Both Williams and Fink shared Grinnell's responses on social media.
"They're anything but leadership-style correspondences."
Williams says she doesn't think the conversation should have taken a political turn. Fink agrees.
"This is a place where we need to be pulling people together, not dividing them. And it's a place where we need to be having conversations instead of arguments."
Williams and Fink both want to keep performing at the Kennedy Center, but they say they want it to be a venue that is welcoming and accessible to all Americans. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Trust in me in all you do. Have the faith I have in you. Love will see us through if only you trust in me. Why don't you trust me? Come to me when things go wrong. Cling to me, Daddy. Oh, yeah, and I'll be strong. We can get along, we can get along.